This is David Soselsky, Southern Oral History Program, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's August 3rd, 1999. This is another in the Southern Oral History Program's Listening for a Change series. Today I'm in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I'm interviewing Ms. Denise Giles.
It's nice to be here today. Let me see if we can... you would just want to say your name and kind of when and where you were born, Denise? And I can look at the tape recorder and make sure that it's coming in.
Okay. My name is Denise Giles, and I was born in Toccoa, Georgia, in 1960.
Toccoa, a big place.
Well, it's bigger now than it was then, but actually my family's from like Hartwell, Northwest Georgia.
Okay.
Kind of a farming community.
Okay.
A few of them were farmers, but the rest of them just kind of survived day to day.
Right. Well, let's get back to that. What's your current position?
I'm the director of Cumberland Interfaith Hospitality Network.
And for the uninitiated, what's that?
What it is, it's a national, part of a national organization that focuses on uniting the religious community in providing shelter and meals and case management and services towards homeless families. And the majority of the people we serve are pretty much under the age of about 10.
Wow.
Because it's, you know, children. We have a mom with two or three kids that come in. And so the bulk of who are here with us are children. And we work with four families at a time. And we have an expansion project that we're working with the Ashton Woods to kind of give people a longer opportunity to get back on track.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly do you like do with the to support these families?
Well, the first thing that we look at is how you got here, and what your part in that is, and we try to work on creating new behaviors. Look at creating resources, increasing the living wage rather than focusing on an earning wage, mm-hmm. and educating people about the lack of affordable housing, and that sometimes we have to sacrifice a little now to get where we want to be a little later, and that we may have to kind of live in an area that's not where we want to be, but it gives us an opportunity to save money to get where we need to be mm-hmm. later on. So that's, we kind of do it short term and long term.
And right now we're sitting at what's called
The Day Center in the Ashton Woods Project.
Right, and you were explaining earlier that it's kind of a dream that you kind of, in some ways, you have to imagine children playing. And
right. It's my personal dream because this is the program that we're developing, that these families will come moving into, is pretty much modeled after my life. And lives of other people who've been homeless for whatever reason, and the time that it takes and the help that it requires for you to move from that place in life to becoming a homeowner mm-hmm. and a community builder.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we start then with your life?
Okay.
Where would you start?
Well, I think I'd probably start near the beginning. My father was in the military. So I was born into a life of movement.
Mm-hmm.
My first memories are living in Hawaii, which I think a lot of people would feel, oh, what a wonderful place to be. I did not like it there. I thought that the waves were too big, being very small. My father was away quite a bit during training, and my mother was pregnant with my first brother. And I guess I kind of felt like I wasn't getting everything I should have.
Right.
Or I just maybe was born with an empty hole. I don't know. But I remember my mother always referring to me as, you know, you just really have to remember that you're not the only person in the house. So so maybe I was a typical self-centered little child. I don't know. But we lived there for 3 years. My brother was born, and we moved. And pretty much from that time until the time I was about seven, our life was a lot of movement. We moved to California, to Oklahoma. And my father went to OCS, became an officer, and the significance of that is in the community that I'm from, very few people leave, right. Number one. And number two, it was very honorable to serve.
Sure.
So my father was kind of considered a hometown hero.
And he was in the Navy?
He was in the Army.
Okay.
In the Army. And we, of course, began to enter the active Vietnam era, and I began to really experience a lot of loss then. My dad was gone. He did three tours, and that required him being away quite a bit. And that's when some changes began to occur in our family. My second brother was born before he left, and so there were three of us children and my mom. And the military was a little different kind of world then. I'm kind of amazed now when I read in the paper people's argument or irritation about where their husbands have gone. And
right.
We were kind of coached or encouraged to always present a positive outlook,
right.
And to always be supportive of whatever mission our government was involved in, right. and those kinds of things. So we didn't have any outlets to express our fear. I remember laying in front of the TV every evening in the evening news when they were showing very vivid scenes of bodies and the dismay of the war, and looking desperately in those crowds of faces for my father's face, because there was long periods of times we didn't see him. When he came back, and I don't remember, life gets blurred in there a little bit, from one tour to another in Vietnam. He began to change. Alcohol became a real big part of his life, and looking back on it now, I can understand a little more clearly and have a lot more compassion for the things that he was dealing with. But at the time, I just didn't understand at all.
Yeah.
And eventually, he became... that became kind of a priority in his life after he was stationed back here at Fort Bragg. Rather than the happy homecoming, I think that someone else came home in his body. And I can't explain that except that
sure.
His eyes weren't the same eyes.
Yeah.
And the person that I knew and trusted and loved wasn't there anymore. He began to become kind of violent in our home. And... my mother pretty much did the best that she could do. She was trying to make up the difference in income,
mm-hmm.
Because that's an addiction that costs,
sure.
And more than just the price of your soul. Sometimes it costs financially as well. And
yeah.
My father was reduced; his command was reduced to a motor pool command, which is kind of for a captain in the military. It was really a bottom for him that he never recovered from. I just remember that I had a lot of responsibility in trying to take care of my brothers and to protect them from the rages that would fly through the house, and also trying to have some sort of normal appearance to life.
Mm-hmm.
We would go to school every day and just act like everything was fine and come home and not know how it was going to be. My mother had to take a second shift job, so she wasn't there. And it kind of left us at his mercy oftentimes, mm-hmm. which was not always kind.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of trust that was violated during that period of time in my life. And I think that I'm not a person who says that, well, I lived in a bad situation and that's the reason I'm the way I am. But I do believe that things that happen in our lives impacts our abilities in having relationships with other people. And so I kind of, something changed in me during that period. Well, my mother was able to gather herself together and to take a stand, which, today people divorce and move a lot easier. But during that period of time in her life and the generation she comes from, this is not something she really felt that she had failed in some way. And I could sense that in her. but she truly was doing the best that she could, and the only thing that she could do to continue to protect us was to get him removed from the home. And that was an interesting endeavor too. It's amazing how domestic violence education has progressed. When people look today, there's a lot that's been accomplished in comparison to then. I remember the sheriffs coming out, and my father had kicked the TV. I think blew up the TV. I don't remember exactly. Children running, screaming. He was eventually put out of the house. He got out of the house and was coming back in, breaking the windows, and it was very violent. And my mother called the sheriff's department, and they came out, and they were like going to leave him there, encouraging, you know, can't y'all just get along, kind of thing. And I think as his drinking progressed and his confusion about where he was, sometimes I was really seriously afraid that he may actually kill us at some point, thinking that he was somewhere else. And now I also know that there's a thing called post-traumatic stress disorder that he obviously was suffering terribly from. But at that time, again, the military didn't acknowledge a lot of, or they weren't aware, whatever, however is politically correct, the situations that resulted in Vietnam. But eventually a neighbor came over and said, you know, this man really needs to be carried away. And so they took him downtown and encouraged him to call someone from Fort Bragg to pick him up. And he moved into the, it was like an officer's quarters thing out at Fort Bragg. And my mother got a legal separation. And there was some sad times in that where he would attempt to get sober, and for a minute you'd have a glimmer of the person you used to know, only to shortly be disappointed and with the reality of a disease that was bigger than any one person. And he wasn't able to see the drinking as a problem. He certainly wasn't able to reach out for help, and it wasn't a time where the military even encouraged it. So the Army agreed to station him somewhere on the other side of the country so that my mother wouldn't pursue any kind of additional legal proceedings. And he was coming up near retirement, and he resigned his commission. And the reason he said he resigned his commission is that he would just soon do without than to have my mother receive any portion of child support garnished out of his wage. His anger was so intense. So again, my mother was put in that position of really having to work real hard to raise us. She was a dedicated Army wife and housewife. She had to start from the bottom and immediately gain momentum in career. And again, that was a period of time in life that I didn't understand what all was going, and I kind of almost felt that she as well had abandoned me.
What did she do?
Well, when she first started off, she got a job in industry, Western Publishing and Black & Decker. Then we went through a series of plant layoffs, and she was, during this time of working crazy hours, she was also going over and taking classes to prepare herself for other things. And she got a job over at Fayetteville State University, where she's worked ever since. It's been, I think maybe 16, 17 years. I'm not quite sure, but it's been a long time. And as I've grown older, I have really, she has become a person whom I have tremendous respect and admiration for. I think oftentimes as kids we miss so much of what's being done in our world around us. But now I look back, without even having the support of kids and having her whole life flipped, it's amazing that she was able to keep us together. And that was one of the things we always discussed. It's very important that you don't get into trouble, because they're going to come and take you away. So we had a lot of fear of being taken away as well, and I think that was a fear she had. I don't know how valid it was. She was a good mom. I think that it was still some of that old thinking, if there are not two parents in the home, there's no value in your family, and somebody's going to come and destroy it. And I think that was a fear that was real for her. I don't know how real. It became real for us, And that has a lot to do with why I stayed in the house to the length that I did. I think that I had wanted to leave since I was about 12 because of the things going on with my father and the violence and the living in fear that he was going to come down the hall in the evening and just come into the room. That was also something that I had to deal with. And I think that the only thing that I needed to do was, you know, to run. The only reason I stayed was I had two brothers that I knew I needed to take care of and a mother who was struggling and needed me to be there. I began to have trouble in school. Just a little bit. Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah. I think I was trying to ask for help in some kind of a way now that I look back. But obviously my plea was not heard for what it was. It was simply seen for what it looked like, and that would be rebellion and disrespect towards authority and all those things that now when I look at children and I see those things, I wonder what's going on at home and what where is it that you came from and what is it that you're trying to say. I think that sometimes we need to listen a little more, not look at what an action is, but maybe listen just a little bit longer, a little bit more intensely, and we may find that what we're seeing in our community is really a cry for help. I think that was for me. I just didn't know how to say help. I just said, I hate you, instead of help me. Mm-hmm. And you know, we can rationalize why all those things would be that way. But at the time, I was just simply trying to survive, and I didn't even know it. I had teachers that really, now that I look back, were trying to help me, that were taking that extra time, asking me questions.
At home.
Yeah, how are things going? Mm-hmm. And knowing that, and no one ever said to me, you don't tell anything that goes in the house, outside of the house, but I think it was just something that I knew. Mm-hmm. And I turned a lot of anger towards those teachers, even though they were the ones reaching out. There was this rule that wasn't allowing me to share, and I hated them for it. Mm-hmm. I got involved in alcohol. My dad actually had left some alcohol in the house, and I had begun drinking that.
Roughly like what age?
12, 13. And it was this immediate, the world is okay thing that hit me. And the next thing that pained me was, I don't want to be my father. I'll never be like that. I'm going to do this now because this is what I need to do, but I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to, you know, you can successfully do this. Well, within a couple of years, I had dropped out of school. I had gotten pregnant and put a child up for adoption.
What grade did you drop out
at? I dropped out in the 11th grade. They passed me. But I didn't show up for probably the last 9 weeks almost. And somehow or another, I passed the 11th grade, and I didn't even show up for the 12th. My whole goal in life was to pursue this state of utopia, this place where I could be in myself and not feel ugly, dirty, overwhelmed with responsibility that were parents' responsibilities and not a child's. And that place, the way I arrived at that was through drinking. And then shortly after that, I met some people who had a whole nother experience to experience. And combined together, it was an amazing event. I went to a party, essentially, and I never came back home. Is what I did. There was
here in Fayetteville.
Yeah, I was here in Fayetteville. There was a house and I noticed there were a lot of people my age. Well, not a lot, but there were a couple people my age and young military guys. other people. You know, it was pretty much a multicultural, just a real neat, everybody coming together and, you know, poo on the government. And, you know, Vietnam has made a disaster of everything. And, you know, education is a lie. And, you know, just all we need to worry about is here and now. And I was like, I have arrived. This is it. You know, this was heaven for me. And the gentleman who, one of the gentlemen in the house, who is my husband now, I really think that God puts people in our paths and we just don't really know what's going on. He was a very moral person in the middle of all of this lava lamp, black light endeavor kind of thing. you know, my goal in life was to meet Timothy Leary and get a recipe. I mean, you know, that was where I was. You know, I wanted to go to the smoke ends in D.C. and, you know, because I thought everybody should just experience this and we wouldn't have problems anymore. And I truly believed that at the time. My husband, who at the time was just a person, kind of when I never left, for some reason he just kind of accepted that. And we just stayed together. And we've been together, this is our 23rd year. And I don't know if, you know, if there was, it, I don't even know how that happened. But it was almost as if he just kind of decided he was going to be the, here's this kid, I guess I'll take care of her. He did think I was a little older. There's 7 years difference in our age. So at that time, it might have looked a lot worse than it does now. I'm 39 and he's like 46, 47. Mm-hmm. And that's not a big discrepancy now. But when you're 15 or 16 and someone's 20 or, you know, that could kind of look. And so when he kind of got the reality of how old I actually was, you know, several years later, he was a little upset with that. But by then we had kind of developed a real fondness for one another and decided to continue moving along. He has put up with a lot. He felt that we needed to have a place to stay. And, you know, to do that, you need to have a job. And so his kind of free love, you know, never work again, ideas were dissipating and he was growing up. And I'm here to not feel, and I'm going to do whatever I need to do to do that. And I became pregnant with my daughter, who is 20 now. And I was in such an oblivion, I wasn't even aware really that I was pregnant until I was about 4 or 5 months. And I did everything wrong.
How old were you then? You were...
I was 18. I did not... I quit doing drugs. But I didn't quit drinking. And I couldn't quit drinking. And I think that at that point, I was starting to really realize that something was getting out of control here. I'm having to drink to feel okay. And I began to feel, I guess, a lot of shame in becoming exactly that thing that I said that I would never be. I wound up delivering my daughter. Thank God she was healthy. Again, you know, we are graced at times for no apparent reason. Mm-hmm. And in spite of me, has grown up to be a beautiful young lady. It was very difficult for her. Her father pretty much took care of her mostly. I was still out trying not to feel. And that's pretty much my... I would have these awareness moments. Shortly after she was born, I thought, well, I probably need to at least go get my GED. Mm-hmm. You know, don't ask me where the thought came from. It was just one of those things. It's something I need to do. Maybe my mother's still in the background harping, you know, at least get your GED. Good Lord. And I think she probably had a lot to do with it. And my husband as well. He had this tendency to continue to, you know, you might want to look at doing something in the future. You know, he didn't pursue it because he would be horribly attacked by me. I would just jump him, not physically, but just verbally, you know, how dare you, you're not my dad. And I would go into all this sickness that, you know, either he's a very, very well person or he's a very sick person to have stayed with me through all that. But I went over to FTCC, and I'm real grateful for the ABE GED program they have over there. It's very respectful. And that I was able to retain some sense of dignity and to build upon that little piece of dignity to the point that I actually thought when I got my GED that I could do something. There is this possibility that I might be able to actually do something. However, I didn't pursue it and kind of fell right back into that same I don't want to feel. I kind of look back and I think that the fear of making an investment, I don't think I was so afraid of failing anymore. I was afraid of actually I might succeed, and that absolutely terrified me. And any time that something shook my world, I didn't want to feel it, so I would medicate myself in whatever form or fashion was available to me.
You were like an all-purpose drinker?
Oh, I would drink it all. I had no... I used to have a saying that, like, if you drink wine, like Wild Irish Rose or something like that, you know, that was the definition of an alcoholic. And if I drank that, then I had really gotten too bad. Or if you drank in the morning, you were an alcoholic. Well, I didn't get up in the morning, so, you know, I didn't technically drink in the morning. It's amazing how insidious the thinking process is as you travel through that total erosion of who you are, and alcohol just becomes who you are. I'm grateful for having traveled that because I think that it allows me to see my dad in a different way, a way that I probably would have never been able to see him, and I certainly probably would never have been able to develop any kind of forgiveness. So I'm grateful for that. I can't tell you... really a lot of, you know, my daughter assures me that I was a decent parent during that time. I know that I was there physically. I don't know how much I was there emotionally for her. My husband was there. But it began to put a strain on everything. My fears of being abandoned or I just couldn't accept the fact that anybody would just love me. Really created such a big vacuum and need that people around me just, you know. I don't know if you've ever bumped into a person that has that real, real intense need, but it's almost like bumping into what I call a life leech. Mm-hmm. And if they get a hold of one person, they will suck you right dry. Mm-hmm. But many people can be of great service to a person in that situation. I kept trying to find the one person that I could latch into, and as soon as they disappointed me,
That was it.
They were written off, and I knew it. So, you know, and if you look hard enough anywhere, you'll find that you're looking for, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. And it's taken me a long time to see that I have vision control, you know, just by thinking what it is I want to see and then looking for that. My husband, the frustration began to kind of grow, and I guess I interpreted that as he was going to abandon me, so I'm going to leave him first kind of thing, or drive him off. And and again, you know, the man has gotten, he's either related to Job or he's a saint, to have even continued in that, and to continue being a parent. And, you know, finally he kind of looked at me and said that, you know, I believe that when you have a child, you have to be there. And that's why I'm here. And he kind of let me know that my activity was kind of creating a divide between us, but he was committed to the relationship, if nothing else, that we had a child together. My daughter began going to school, and I was having a difficult time showing up for all those things, and was becoming acutely aware of it. I'd be late because I was just going to have one more drink before I got there. I'm sure I humiliated her on many occasions, except that she will not say that ever happened, or she hasn't yet. I began to become ashamed of who I was and what was happening to me. I began to steal from my husband, and he would think the bills were paid and they weren't paid, and we wound up homeless. We lived in a station wagon with two cats and a dog and our child. And we would park at the drive-in during the day, and I would pretend like we had the biggest TV screen in the world and that my daughter had the biggest playground in her own front yard. And I'd have to go to places that had exterior bathrooms to clean up. My husband was trying to, you know, keep his job going, and I was becoming resigned of it. This isn't so bad, and look, we don't have to spend money on rent. Well, that's more money. At the time, I think he was doing some construction work. I can't even remember. It may have been roofing or construction. He had been through a variety of little different trades. We eventually contacted a landlord that was in the neighborhood of the original house that I had met him in. And they let us move in and let us kind of pay as we went. And the gentleman was so kind. We paid $90 a month rent, and half the time we couldn't even keep that going. You know, well, my husband could kept it going if it hadn't have been for me.
Wait, what year would this have been?
Would have been, now we're probably up to about 79, 80, right around 79. Mm-hmm. And then they were tearing those houses down, or they weren't actually tearing them down. Some other people were coming in and buying them, and they were going to expect people to pay real rent there on time. What a concept. At that point, I was going through another one of my, okay, I'm going to sober up phases, and got a job, and my husband got a different job over at Mako, where he began sanding and taping cars, and he started talking about, you know, maybe I could learn to do body work. You know, he knew that somebody in this family had to get something going to sustain us, and he never said it. He just said that this is, you know, what I need to do. And he began to learn and caught a lot of flack for it. I'm in a multicultural relationship. My husband is black, and I guess that's when I began to kind of first experience some of the institutional racism that exists. I think that it was difficult for people to take him serious. You know, here you're a sander, masker, and you want to be a body man, all right. But the owner of the shop said, okay, you can do some little things here and there, and it really bolstered his confidence, and he began to do work in our yard, side work, developing his skills. We had moved right across the street from where he worked, so that was convenient. I was babysitting some of their kids. Things were going okay. My daughter was struggling. She was starting to have some problems in school, some authority issues, and I was starting to see my life kind of happening all over again in my daughter, and it was really creating a problem for me. And I thought, well, okay, I'm going to be a good example, so I'm going to go back over to FTCC, and I did. And I went through a emergency medical technician training. It's a 2-year course, and succeeded in probably getting half my class drunk the majority of the time that we were there. We'd go celebrate and study. People were amazed, but I had a difficult time studying sober. But I was doing binge drinking at the time. I wasn't drinking every day. I was doing binge drinking, so I was probably more functional than I had been in the previous years of my life. And we started off with about, I guess, 20 or 30 people, and we graduated about 8, and I was the only female left. And this being a military town, at the time, you know, all the guys were hardcore military, and it took a little bit of difficulty to earn some respect. But when they saw that, I could drink as good as the rest of them, but as well as, I had the ability to do what I was doing. Blood did not frighten me. I grew up in blood and violence. I wasn't afraid of things that a lot of people are typically afraid of entering into. maybe a crowd, a hysteria situation, because that was kind of at the breakfast table kind of thing for me. So, you know, these kinds of things did not shock nor bother me. However, people who had been dead for a period of time did tend to create a difficult situation for me. That was one thing that I was not able to overcome. That simply had to do with some smells and distortions of body that I just couldn't get past that. And so they got a kick out of that there was finally something that stopped me. I was a distinguished honor graduate in my class, and thought, wow, you know, I've found my niche, and wasn't nearly as overweight as I am now, so I could still function physically. And I don't know what happened. I was not able to apply for the job. You know, it's like I still didn't believe that I was really qualified. All those old fears of, you know, you're not, this isn't real, because I lived this double life so long. Go to school, everything's fine at home. Go home, it was a nightmare. I kind of felt that maybe somehow or another I had faked it through there. Mm-hmm. And even today, I still kind of wonder sometimes when things come my way. Is this real? Do people really know? If they knew who I really was, would they still extend this to me? Would they? And I guess we'll find out a little bit.
I've been having some technical, well, I don't know what it did. It's working now, but once or twice it has, it blanked out on me on the last interview I did. That's why I'm looking at it so often, but.
It's having a nervous breakdown.
I think it is.
Yeah, I forgot.
It probably has its own story. But
it probably does. We need to interview the tape recorder.
At some point. You said you walked into the bar.
They didn't even turn.
With your Harley shirt and.
I didn't even turn around. I didn't get the judgment that I thought I was going to get. I mean, actually, nobody even noticed me coming in, and that just kind of like threw me for a loop. And now, at this time, I have not yet, and I'm referring to my husband in the present tense. We were not married yet, and that was also based on anti-government issues. I was not going to be conformed into contracts I don't even have the argument anymore. It's right. It's just so faded, but it was somewhere in there. But I began to attend there. I began to show up there instead of showing up at the bar.
What was the church's name?
It was Faith Temple.
And non-denominational?
Yeah, it was non-denominational, and it was an experience that I'd never experienced before.
And what was the bar's name?
Let's see, it was a Shady Lady.
Shady Lady.
Shady Lady Lounge on Fort Bragg Road. Kind of, there was a whole little strip of them. They were all convenient, particularly if you weren't driving. It was really great because you could just, as long as you didn't get hit by a car in between, mm-hmm. you could go from place to place. And there was the Flaming Mug and the Gaslight Plaza and AJ's. And I worked in a lot of these places because I would get tabs, and then, of course, you would have to, you know, AJ's was a steak and hoagie place, and I worked there. I used to think to support my family, but actually it was to cover Friday and Saturday night. But kind of staggered across there and began attending, and I guess having some people that really seemed to have no investment in me but actually kind of cared about me, I could kind of get over the differences of the religious kind of thing. They did some things that were very new to me. And I just was like, well, no big deal. Excuse me. And I said, well, you know, I'll give this a shot. And I began to go regularly, became extremely involved, and was really, had cut my drinking down to maybe just weekend kind of thing, and it was very occasional. Things began to happen to me that I didn't understand. I understand now a little better looking back. When I didn't drink, all the things that I drank for would come rushing back, feeling. And it seemed like they were all intensified and much bigger than they were when I had stopped, like the guilt, the shame. And they were all mixed up into a big ball. I couldn't identify. It was just I felt bad and unworthy. So I continued to kind of think that I've got to get good enough to go to God. When you hear preaching or you hear people talking, and this is the again, it's what you see, what you believe taints everything you hear. I began to hear that there were all these things that I had to do to get right, mm-hmm. and one was to get married. And I came home one day and I said, we were getting ready to move from the house that we were in across town. A friend of mine had bought a house and was going to allow us to rent it really cheap, and which was going to allow me to continue. She was real pleased that I was kind of slacking off, and it's another one of these people that invested in my future, and I didn't treat her well for it in the end. But the idea was, I told him, if you want to move into the house with me, we have to get married. I mean, I just came in and just dropped that on me, kind of looked at me. He was like, well, I hadn't really planned on that today. And then immediately my you don't love me, I knew it all along kind of flew up. And I was like, well, fine, it doesn't matter anyway. I'm moving, you can find your own place. And he said, well, he didn't say that. Well, we had to, he said he would marry me. And that, you know, it was probably about time. And my daughter was really excited. She thought that was kind of neat. And I went back to the church and said, we want to get married. Well, they were kind of shocked that we weren't married, number one. And then they said, well, we don't marry anybody unless they have counseling. And I'm like, oh, I'll never get him drug in here. He'd already said, you know, he wasn't too much into a lot of drama in church. He's kind of a quiet church person himself. Well, he came. And we went through counseling and they married us. And I don't know what the day is that we got married. I know that the date, it was March 23rd, but I don't know what year it was. And one of these days I'm going to pull out that license and find out.
and the church was cool, completely cool with the black and white thing?
Yeah, that was one advantage of being in an interdenominational.
I was going to say, anywhere
yeah,
else.
Yeah, because that really wasn't an issue for them. They were just kind of, the big issue was living together and not being married. That was their issue, and they talked to us about making a commitment to God. And one thing that I can say is, Kenny and I made a commitment before God long before we ever got married, and I think that's what held us through. At least it's what held him through. I wasn't even aware enough to leave most of the time, But there was a difference in our relationship. I think a security hit me that I didn't have before. The fact that, you know, I did have a piece of paper that we had both signed, and we did make a commitment, a verbal commitment in front of other people. And all of a sudden I saw the value of marriage, not being all that government hoopla that, you know, it's a tax deduction kind of thing. I saw what it really was, and I kind of regretted that I had missed that. I got my feelings hurt in church, is what it winds up coming down to after a period of time. Somebody hurt my feelings, and I just staggered back across the street and picked up where I left off.
Now, after you were married?
Oh, this is after we were married. I don't even remember the event. But what it tells me is that I still hadn't learned how to deal with emotions. Even being sober for a little while, I just could not, or being sober for periods of time, I could not, any emotion, just, it waylaid me. It just took me totally out. So I just staggered back across the street where all my friends were. They were like, oh, I hadn't seen you in a while. You know, it had been months. And, you know, I was like, oh, okay. But it was okay. I got my seat back, and they still gave me a tab. And, you know, that's when you know you've arrived, when you have a tab in a bar. Just began to pursue that. And I went downhill so fast. It was like I jumped off of a cliff. Something about alcoholism, and I don't know if people are aware or if it's true for others. I know it was true for me, that those periods of times that you don't drink, it's still progressing within you. And when you go back to that, it's as if you never stopped. And it's sudden and it's swift, and you just go so fast down the tubes. And that's what happened. I just went down there very quickly. I mean, I